Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Hi, everyone. Today, it is my pleasure to interview Decker Fraser, and we talk about go-to-market strategies. We talk about SaaS marketing, lots of interesting things here. Decker has over 10 years of experience in software marketing for companies, including Sony and the Google-backed startup Rocket Lawyer. He's also the author of several product marketing books. One of them is Product Launch, How to Go to Market. And I'm super excited to have him on the show today. Decker, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm super excited too. Thank you for having me.
So give people like 30 seconds on how did you get started in the tech world?
I got started because I come from a family of entrepreneurs, and my older brothers had started a number of different software companies and they needed help with marketing. So they really took me under their wing, and I kind of learned from trial and error from there.
When was it?
Oh, this was over the past 20 years or so. I ended up going to Kellogg School of Management to kind of piece together all that tactical stuff into some sort of strategic framework, because a lot of what I had learned was just kind of playing around and experimenting.
Got it. So your book came out fairly recently, a few months ago, right? Last year.
That's right.
So in the book, you talk about the 7 key pillars of any successful go-to-market strategy. Can you share with us kind of a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is an overall framework for how to bring a product to market. And a lot of the experience I had and my co-author had was in the tech space. So we draw on a lot of examples from software. The first key thing to consider is the target market that you're participating in, with a special emphasis on the audience and who you want to derive value from the product. And that's not just the customers you're going after, but also the partners that you want to collaborate with and the collaborators that help bring your product to market. The second is the value proposition. So how is it that you're creating value in the target market that is above and beyond what competing SaaS products are delivering on? And that's not just creating value for customers, but it's also strategically important to create value for your partners as well. The third key thing is your messaging. Messaging is super important. A big part of that is the positioning that goes with that. Your go-to-market team, another key component. Are you going to have SDRs or BDRs? Are you going to hire the right sales team? How is sales going to work with marketing? Those sort of considerations. Something that really gets undervalued by marketers working with small startups, particularly business-to-business startups, is just how important demand generation is. And having a really robust, sophisticated demand generation system so that you're not just making brand marketing decisions, or not just making strategic level decisions, but also those tactical nitty-gritty lead generation, customer acquisition decisions. And of course, the marketing mix is very important, all the different tactics that go into your marketing plan. And I place special emphasis on pricing, because pricing is part of the marketing mix, but it's so important, because the second that you drop the price in your SaaS product, you can see a surge in demand. And the second you increase the price, you can see your sales pipeline just plummet.
Decker, which one of those 7 do you see most people have problems with or make mistake?
I think one of the biggest mistakes is there's this myth floating around in the marketing sphere and in the SaaS sphere that your target market is the same thing as your target customer. And that leads down all sorts of paths that are going to get into trouble. So the first thing is you're ignoring collaborators, you're ignoring partners, you're ignoring key influencers, you're ignoring all those bigger software companies that you could be partnering with. So just to give you an example, you could get a single contract with a company, a partner, that could be worth 10 years worth of demand generation. So if you treat the target market just as the customers, you're making a huge mistake. And if you look at a lot of successful startups that have made it to the medium and large size and they're really scaling fast, a lot of it is because of partnership marketing and getting that mutualism going with other businesses. The other big mistake is not focusing on markets that are big enough. So there's been a really popular marketing book out there called Blue Ocean Strategy. I think it's great. I think going into markets that have little competition can be very smart and very lucrative. But I also think it can be a huge mistake, because what people end up doing is they pick these tiny little niche markets that have no competition, but also have tiny demand. So your SaaS product never really blows up because there just isn't a big enough revenue there to make a substantial business out of it.
Got it. So basically what I see often as well is that either founders choose too broad of an area or industry, and then they go after that whole area without narrowing it down, or they go in too narrow without the potential to expand, right? So both are problematic ways to go about it. Because if you're choosing too narrow and there's no potential, then basically you're stuck with that tiny niche. So for example, let's say 5,000 people. And then once you're done going through, you know, your 5,000 people, there's nothing else for you to expand to, right? And the same way, if you're choosing a too broad of a market and then you are not narrowing it down, at least in the beginning, right? Because you cannot talk to everyone. You need to speak to a smaller audience or like a sleeve of the audience. And then once you are confident that, you know, this is the way you work with them, you can expand to, you know, a neighboring audience, right?
Absolutely. And I've definitely seen the reverse mistake made, and it has been catastrophic. I've seen millions of dollars plummeted into the strategy where they look at a big market and they say, oh, if we can just have a tiny piece of it, and then they get crushed. Because one of the biggest problems you run into when you take that strategy and you go after too big a market is that the players in that space have huge competitive moats around them. And the biggest moat there is in the market is economies of scale. So if you're just a small guy or woman with a small team, there's no way you can compete with somebody that has massive scale like that or massive venture capital behind them. But if you do have a lot of venture capital and there's a lot of expectations from investors, then you need to make sure you're sizing the market, you're sizing demand, you're looking at the keyword research to see how many people are actually looking for this. And then you can figure out if it'll match your goals. Is the target market the right size to help you reach your financial objectives?
I also really like your comment about not considering key influencers or potential partners. That's exactly what I'm doing with one of the founders that I currently work with, where he is in the e-commerce space, but he has not even considered reaching out to agencies or other softwares that are not directly competing, but basically serving exactly the same market, to partner up with them. And then there are so many opportunities to go around, right? So what would be some of the potential steps after we've identified a potential influencer or another partner that we can work with, that we have similar audiences? How would you recommend starting the conversation with them?
There's a million different ways. I think the best way is just to see if you have a mutual connection who can make an introduction. I think that's particularly important if the key influencer is actually an organization that's larger than yours. You want to go through somebody maybe from your college network, maybe a mutual LinkedIn connection. If the key influencer is somebody maybe on a smaller scale, maybe it's a professional like a lawyer who has expertise in a specific space, then you can reach out to that person directly through LinkedIn. You can have that conversation through email. There's tons of different ways to help build that relationship. Another thing is, particularly if you're in the business to consumer space, is just send free samples to those influencers. Get them to try your product. They might love it and be excited to talk about it.
I love it. But I also want to mention that do not be hung up. Even if the company is a larger size, don't think that you are too small for them. Like I think that so many founders make this mistake, like, oh, I'm not big enough for them, or, you know, I'm not even going to bother. You know what? So many founders, even when they have larger startups, they're still very receptive to any friendly, not weird, right? And by weird, I mean, like, when you reach out and you sound like a robot, like, you know, you're sending a script, like, be genuine and be like friendly, like you're reaching out to a friend. And this is, I think, the key to reaching out to those potential opportunities.
Yeah, exactly. Be personable. I remember seeing a lot of big mistakes with small companies is they're a little bit insecure about their size, and they go through a lot of effort to sound bigger than they actually are. But people, they don't want to work with a corporation all the time. Sometimes they want to work with the lone wolf, or they want to work with the small startup that's helping their community, and there's an exciting story behind it. So when you reach out to them, yeah, you can be personable. The other thing to keep in mind is that most people are receptive to flattery. So if you're reaching out to an influencer and you're a fanboy of their page or their YouTube channel and you love it, then tell them that. They want to hear that. And that helps open the door. It helps lubricate the conversation.
I agree. But don't be fakey. Like if you are not, do not say that you've been reading their blog for the past couple of months or years. That sounds not genuine at all, right? But if you really did, I think remembering when was the last time that you've connected with them or subscribed to their blog or what it is that you were going through, and how they helped you, I think is really going to be flattering to them.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that about the economy of scale and how can smaller startups compete with bigger ones, especially with VC-backed startups. Do you have any recommendations? Because that's a lot of times I do hear something like this from founders, like, we're too small. I don't know how to go about that. They are really big. How do I even start?
Yeah. So one of the easiest answers to that is, instead of trying to be everything, you can become part of a larger ecosystem. So some examples of that would be the Salesforce AppExchange. Instead of trying to be the next CRM, just try to be that little piece of add-on to the Salesforce ecosystem. Similarly with Intuit, there's apps.com. There's also Google Chrome. So a good example I like to highlight there is that there's a startup that helps Amazon sellers and Jungle Scout. And one of the ways that they got a lot of traction was by going on the Google Chrome store. So you don't need to capture the entire relationship with the customer. You can just play a smaller role. And when you're a small company, that's all you need to make those millions or whatever it is that your target is.
So we're talking about a couple of things. So one thing is basically being an integration to an existing big solution, right? And this is something that actually my husband SaaS is doing. And definitely there are some pitfalls there and like things to be aware of that, well, right now the system doesn't have, the solution or integration, right? But what if, in a year, in 2 years, just when you are about to scale and, get this traction, they are rolling out their own solution to your problem. So definitely be, cautious about that and think before pouring so much energy into this.
Yeah, I think something that'd be really helpful is I recently released a competitive analysis template. It's available for free. And I talk about the various types of competitive advantages. So what these really are is things that prevent competitors from taking customers away from you. So if you go to market and then a big player comes out with a competing offering that adds on what you already deliver, these competitive advantages make it very, very difficult for them to take customers because they're stuck to you. And I go through some of those things. So customer captivity is one of the biggest ones. So customers are in the habit of using your product daily instead of monthly, then they're going to be more stuck to your product. If you build in switching costs into your product, that's also going to make you stickier. So economies of scale is the strongest competitive advantage, but it's certainly not the only one. The one that you should really be focusing on as a small startup is customer captivity. How do you make customers stick to you and make them not even want to leave?
Can you give us a couple more examples? You mentioned that if there's a switching cost and then if they're using your product daily, any other opportunities for us to grab those customers and not let them go?
Yeah, so switching costs is one of the biggest ones. Search costs. So if it's difficult to find a replacement for what you do, that's a competitive moat. And the other big one is government protection. So if you have a patent to protect your product, that would also be helpful. Or if you're the other thing is it's difficult to get economies of scale when you're dealing with a huge SaaS market like the United States. But often what we see with successful startups is They simply replicate what was done in the United States or elsewhere and brought it to another country. So like New Zealand's a perfect example. New Zealand has carbon copies of eBay. New Zealand was the startup ground for Xero software that competes with Intuit. So you can build economies of scale in smaller regional markets. And now I'm starting to see this here in Indonesia as well.
One more thing I want to add to this list is relationships. Build relationship with your customers. And I think this is probably one of the most important things. If they really like you, your personality, working with your team, they've built this trust with you. The other thing that I recommend is have those weekly meetings where you invite your customers, your leads, everyone really who your prospects who wants to hear about your solution or research in a solution like yours. Have those weekly hour-long kind of webinars or sessions where anyone can join, ask your questions, just chat with you. I think this is really valuable. So this could be part of this building relationships where you actually talking to your customers. And even if someone's going to do another similar service that's going to be, I don't know, $50 less, the hassle of going through the switch from you to them, but also this relationship, they kind of don't want to go anywhere because they know that they can get this answer or they can hop on a meeting with you fairly quickly. I think this is really important.
Hugely important. And that's why we've seen the tremendous growth in the Department of Customer Success in the SaaS industry is really real. Companies have really started to realize what you're talking about, which is just how important that relationship is. Not just in terms of acquiring customers, but keeping them happy, keeping them engaged. And I think it's really, really important in the early stages because a lot of the people that are adopting your product in the early stages are influencers. These may be tech gurus, these may be developers. These are people that probably are more dedicated and interested in your product to a deeper level, and they're going to be influencing other developers, clients of theirs, people on Reddit, people on Quora. So they have a disproportionate share of voice in the market. So engaging them is not a waste of your time. Also, I want to highlight James Lemkin, founder of Saster. He points out that there's really little reason you should not be doing a webinar every week.
I didn't know that.
So one of the things he points out is webinars almost always pay off. So having that weekly webinar with your customers is great. It engages them. It's something you can push out to prospective customers as well in your sales pipeline. And it's a great way to generate leads.
Awesome. In your book, you talk a little bit about the segmentation. And what I see happens often with early stage founders is they have acquired a few dozen of customers, but then they're stuck because they don't know, because those customers are from all kinds of industries and they're stuck. They don't know which industry to go after. So what I really recommend, okay, you have, let's say, 20 customers or 50 customers. Have all of those customers on a spreadsheet and then figure out what the industry is, how big is the company, I don't know, any single kind of criteria you can think about, put it in the spreadsheet and then try to identify, is it your best customer? How much are they paying you? Are they on your lowest tier or your highest tier? So all of those criteria, put it in the spreadsheet and then see if there are any similarities. Try to identify, okay, those four customers are from, I don't know, marketing agencies or from manufacturing. That means that, okay, maybe that's the segment that you need to go after first if you are in the beginning that you weren't sure which to go after and you kind of have everyone. What's your experience with segmentations? Do you have any other tips or recommendations how we should go about it?
Yeah, I have tons of recommendations with segmentation. I think the biggest mistake that people make is they come up with a persona that's based on demographic data. So things like how old somebody is, what their gender is, what their age is. And usually sometimes these things matter, but usually they don't. Usually what you're looking at is things like how are they deriving value from your product? And often that correlates with the type of industry that you're in, which is what you're pointing out, or it correlates with other things such as what is the problem that they want. So just don't segment arbitrarily based on things that are easy. Actually look at what actually matters and what aligns with your product. I also find when you're marketing vertical or industry specific SaaS, your job gets a lot easier because you can size the market easier. You can get a list of prospects. You don't have to waste a lot of time generating leads. You can just buy the leads and then focus your efforts on nurturing them and converting them into customers. There's millions of different ways to segment. One of the most sophisticated ways is a statistical technique called cluster analysis, but probably in the very early stages, it's going to be more experimentation than anything.
Tell us about cluster analysis.
So cluster analysis is using machine learning by aggregating all different data points on your customers. So it's going to be things like how long they use your software, how much they spend on your software, how many employees they have. You standardize all that data. You put it into your SPS or statistical program, and you find out what are the actual segments that are clustering, you know? Because we sometimes make assumptions and we say, oh, you know, this is CEOs who belong in this industry and they make this much money. But a lot of the times it's a fantasy. We have fabricated ideas of who we think a segment is, but often those variables cross over the statistical segments that actually exist in the market. And we as humans, we're not actually very good at looking at large pieces of data like that. You know, we get confused once there's more than five variables. So when you're dealing with 100 variables, you need to rely on science to create the segments for you.
What are some mistakes that you see founders make, especially in the early stage?
I think one of the big things is that they believe that benefits are more important than features. There's kind of this myth in the marketing realm that, oh, if we just talk about the product features, nobody cares. What does it really mean? Oh, it means you save money, or it means you feel good, or you feel less stressed. But in reality, a lot of the time with SaaS products, what the customer really cares about is the functional features that you deliver on. And when they see a website or a landing page that's full of benefits, they don't actually know what you do. I mean, there's a million software pieces out there that save you time and save you money, but it's what do you actually do? And I was also looking at research from the top management consultancy, McKinsey, and they're talking about viral campaigns. So what makes products go viral? What makes people talk about them? And usually marketers try to make things go viral with emotional positioning. So messages around high level benefits, but guess what customers actually talk about? Guess what actually goes viral? It's the functional benefits. It's the features. It's the things that solve those immediate pains that they have. Those are the things they talk about. I think another big mistake, this is something James Lemkin from Saster talks about, is hiring marketing managers or marketing consultants who don't understand demand generation. Demand generation is highly tactical, and it gets undervalued with a lot of people that have experience in large companies. So if you're hiring somebody from a larger company, often they don't understand demand generation. A lot of marketers do not have a sophisticated understanding of demand generation because they spend a lot of time building brands and protecting brands. Another big mistake is getting into the marketing strategy without having a goal. So your strategy is just a means of achieving your goal. So maybe your goal is you just want to create enough money to support yourself. Maybe your goal is to retire. Maybe you're trying to get 10 million ARR in the next couple of years. So once you have a goal, then the marketing strategy starts to make sense. Then you know you can go after a small market, or you have to go after a large market. It also dictates what tactics to use. Do you need to do advertising because you need immediate results, or can you focus on long-term results through things like content marketing?
Awesome. Decker, tell us about your one-page product marketing plan template. You agreed to share that with the listeners. Tell us, where can founders learn more about you and then get this template?
So the best way to learn more about me is just connect with me on LinkedIn and just talk to me, find out, so I can find out what it is that you need help with or what you're looking for. I can set you up with the right people or the right templates. I have a free template available. It's a one-page simple template that gives you a comprehensive overview of putting a marketing plan together, fully editable within Word.
Decker, any last parting words?
Good luck. All right, thanks All right. a lot.
And that's it for this episode. For those tech founders who have a remote team, I have a question. Do you find yourself that it's much faster for you to do things by yourself than waste all of that mental energy delegating tasks to someone, and so you either don't hire anyone, or if you already have a remote team,
you're guilty of doing those tasks by yourself, because there's just so much energy goes into delegating the tasks and then just managing people. Are you able to take a few days off and not be worried that your servers will go down or your support is going to blow up? What if you could work on more strategic, important things and let your team fix the bugs? If you only started building your team in the last couple of years, I guarantee that you are making lots of mistakes that hinder your growth without even realizing that. Oftentimes, you, the founder, may end up being the bottleneck to your team's success. That is definitely hard to swallow, but it's true. But also look on the bright side, this is also the easiest problem for you to fix because you are in control of how to fix it. I'll be launching soon a program that will help tech founders improve your team performance and as a result, remove the roadblocks to scaling your SaaS just by improving your operations and team dynamic. This is really the shortcut. To be notified when it's live, go to my website, natalieluneva.com/team. natalieluneva.com/team.